The Reluctant Dragon by Kenneth Graham, Part 1. Footprints in the snow have been unfailing provokers of sentiment ever since snow was first a white wonder in this drab-colored world of ours. In a poetry book presented to one of us by an aunt, there was a poem by one Wadsworth in which they stood out strongly, with a picture all to themselves, too. But we didn't think very highly either of the poem or the sentiment. Footprints in the sand, now, were quite another matter, and we grasped Crusoe's attitude of mind much more easily than Wadsworth's. Excitement and mystery, curiosity and suspense, these were the only sentiments that tracks, whether in sand or in snow, were able to arouse in us. We had awakened early that winter morning, puzzled at first by the added light that filled the room. Then, when the truth was at last fully dawned on us, and we knew that snowballing was no longer a wistful dream, but a solid certainty waiting for us outside, it was a mere brute fight for the necessary clothes, and the lacing of boots seemed a clumsy invention, and the buttoning of coats an unduly tedious form of fastening, with all that snow going to waste at our very door. When dinner time came, we had to be dragged in by the scruff of our necks. The short armistice over, the combat was resumed, but presently Charlotte and I, a little weary of contests and of missiles that ran shudderingly down inside one's clothes, forsook the trampled battlefield of the lawn, and went exploring the blank virgin spaces of the white world that lay beyond. It stretched away unbroken on every side of us, this mysterious soft garment under which our familiar world had so suddenly hidden itself. Faint imprint showed where a casual bird had alighted, but of other traffic there was next to no sign, which made these strange tracks all the more puzzling. We came across them first at the corner of the shrubbery, and pored over them long, our hands on our knees. Experienced trappers that we knew ourselves to be, it was annoying to be brought up suddenly by a beast we could not at once identify. "Don't you know?" said Charlotte rather scornfully. "Thought you knew all the beasts that ever was." That put me on my mettle, and I hastily rattled off a string of animal names embracing both the Arctic and the tropic zones, but without much real confidence. "No," said Charlotte on consideration, "they won't any of 'em quite do. Seems like something lizardy. Did you say an iguanodone? Maybe that, p'raps. But that's not British, and we want a real British beast. I think it's a dragon." "'Tisn't half big enough," I objected. "Well, all dragons must be small to begin with," said Charlotte, "like everything else. Perhaps this is a little dragon who's got lost. A little dragon would be rather nice to have. He might scratch and spit, but he couldn't do anything, really. Let's track him down." So we set off into the wide, snow-clad world, hand in hand, our hearts big with expectation, complacently confident that by a few smudgy traces in the snow we were in a fair way to capture a half-grown specimen of a fabulous beast. We ran the monster across the paddocks and along the hedge of the next field, and then he took to the road like any tame, civilized taxpayer. Here his tracks became blended with and lost among more ordinary footprints, but imagination and a fixed idea will do a great deal, and we were sure we knew the direction a dragon would naturally take. The traces, too, kept reappearing at intervals. At least Charlotte maintained they did, and as it was her dragon, I left the following of the slot to her and trotted along peacefully, feeling that it was an expedition anyhow, and something was sure to come out of it. Charlotte took me across another field or two and through a copse and into a fresh road, and I began to feel sure it was only her confounded pride that made her go on pretending to see dragon tracks instead of owning she was entirely at fault, like a reasonable person. At last she dragged me excitedly through a gap in a hedge of an obviously private character. the waste open world of field and hedgerow disappeared, and we found ourselves in a garden, well kept, secluded, most undragon-haunted in appearance. Once inside, I knew where we were. This was the garden of my friend the circus man, though I had never approached it before by a lawless gap from this unfamiliar side. And here was the circus man himself, placidly smoking a pipe as he strolled up and down the walks. I stepped up to him and asked politely if he had lately seen a beast. "May I inquire," he said with all civility, "what particular sort of beast you may happen to be looking for?" "It's a lizardy sort of beast," I explained. "Charlotte says it's a dragon, but she doesn't really know much about beasts." The circus man looked round about him slowly. "I don't think," he said, "that I've seen a dragon in these parts recently. But if I come across one, I'll know it belongs to you, and I'll have him taken round to you at once." "Thank you very much," said Charlotte. "But don't trouble about it, please, 'cause perhaps it isn't a dragon after all. Only I thought I saw little footprints in the snow, and we followed 'em up, and they seemed to lead right in here. But maybe it's all a mistake, and thank you all the same." "Oh, no trouble at all," said the circus man cheerfully. "I should be only too pleased. But of course, as you say, it may be a mistake. And it's getting dark, and he seems to have got away for the present, whatever he is. You'd better come in and have some tea. I'm quite alone, and we'll make a roaring fire, and I've got the biggest book of beasts you ever saw. It's got every beast in the world and all of 'em colored, and we'll try and find your beast in it." We were always ready for tea at any time, and especially when combined with beasts. There was marmalade, too, and apricot jam brought in especially for us. And afterwards the beast book was spread out, and, as the man had truly said, it contained every sort of beast that had ever been in the world. The striking of 6 o'clock set the more prudent Charlotte nudging me, and we recalled ourselves with an effort from beast land and reluctantly stood up to go. "Here, I'm coming with you," said the circus man. "I want another pipe, and a walk'll do me good. You needn't talk to me unless you like." Our spirits rose to their wonted level again. The way had seemed so long, the outside world so dark and eerie after the bright warm room and the highly colored beast book. But a walk with a real man, why, that was a treat in itself. We set off briskly, the man in the middle. I looked up at him and wondered whether I should ever live to smoke a big pipe with that careless sort of majesty. But Charlotte, whose young mind was not set on tobacco as a possible goal, made herself heard from the other side. "Now then," she said, "tell us a story, please, won't you?" The man sighed heavily and looked about him. "I knew it," he groaned. "I knew I should have to tell a story. Oh, why did I leave my pleasant fireside? Well, I will tell you a story. Only let me think a moment." So he thought a minute, and then he told us this story.